Okay, Erev Tov, everybody, welcome to our weekly Parshat HaShavuot. It's a pleasure to welcome Rabbi Sam Berkovitz, who I'm having the pleasure of meeting for the first time. Rabbi Sam teaches, as you heard, at SAR. I think that's Salanter Academy of Riverdale. Is that what it stands for?
At Salanter Akiva of Riverdale.
Oh, Salanter Akiva, not Academy. Okay, I teach at the Hebrew Academy of Toronto. That's okay, Salanter Akiva of Riverdale. Okay, I teach his Talmud and Machshavat Yisrael. He's finishing up a PhD at master's at Revel at YU. He has served as a rabbinic interim at KJ, and it's a pleasure to welcome here as his debut on Torah Motion. Bakasha, Rabbi.
Thank you so much, Rabbi Kalman. And thank you, everyone, for joining today. I love teaching, hence I'm also a teacher, but I haven't taught for a while. So it's nice before my school year starts that I get to learn with all of you. I'm actually very grateful for that. Not just to like restart my teaching gears, but also both the Sefer and the Parsha and topic that we're going to learn today, I think is a great start for me for the school year. I teach Tanakh and Machshava in SAR, a little bit of Gemara at Talmud as well. But this is my first year teaching Sefer Devarim, which is the Sefer we are now in the middle of in Parshat Shavua. So I'm very excited about that. And also part of me, like a small part of the back of my head over the summer, like especially as school gets closer up, is like, do I remember how to teach? Do I remember the fundamental basic like skills of Tanakh? And that's obviously very like silly. But when I was prepping this year, I realized like as I was going through it, the topic that we're going to do today really highlights the fundamental skills of Tanakh learning, at least how I teach it, meaning a good mixture of grammar, literary analysis, and parshanim, all really linked together in a really great way. I actually tried to limit the sources to like things you could find in an average Beit Midrash, just because like I think it's important to keep things accessible as well, especially when you're going to focus on like skills as we're going to do today. Not overly, but it will be still like a nice, great example epitome of Tanakh analysis. So the topic that we are going to be doing today is the opening of this week's Parshat Ki Tavo, which is the Mikra Bikurim, the recitation of the first fruits that were offered. I want to give some context here just for a little bit, just so we like recognize what we're about to be reading on two different levels. First, as I mentioned before, for the past couple of while, we've been learning Sefer Devarim. Devarim is very, very different than all the other four parts. Well, there's five parts, but all the other four parts of Chumash, where it is for the most part written in the voice of Moshe. And there's many memrot of Chazal, very sayings of Chazal, how Moshe maybe wrote the Sefer and Hashem gave him like the stamp of approval. And we could analyze, especially what we're doing today, as not just words from Hashem, but how Moshe is gearing B'nai Yisrael at this very pivotal moment when they're about to enter the land. How does he shape, deliver, alter his message to really share practical, meaningful, lived experiences to them as they enter the land? So that's one part, but also another part, what we're not going to focus so much on today on the outset is how does Moshe kind of recontextualize some of the things that he's repeating. Many of the mitzvot that we learn in Sefer Devarim are mentioned earlier. The one we're about to learn in particular is mentioned earlier. The main mitzvah we're going to focus on is the obligation on the farmer, when he grows the first fruits of his land, he needs to bring it to the Beit HaMikdash. This is called the mitzvah of Bikurim. The mitzvah of Bikurim is mentioned like four other times in Chumash, maybe five, I don't know, I'm actually thinking about, twice in Shemot. In Shemot, it's in the same context as, same context of all the Chagim, like when you go to there's a mitzvah on Odi Chagim to go Aliyah L'Regel, to visit Yerushalayim, to visit the Beit HaMikdash, the temple. And while you're going there, it says, bring your first fruits. Very practical idea. When you're already going to Yerushalayim, bring it. But that's all it says. It, literally, it's one pasuk twice with the same wording in Shemot. It's mentioned once in, I can't remember Vayikra, but Midbar, it's mentioned one other time in Devarim, and actually from the point of view of the priest. Here, we have a new context for it. One that I want to focus on right from the outset. Does not mention the Chagim at all in this section of Devarim. Here is the context. V'haya ki tavo el ha'aretz, asher Hashem Elokecha noten lecha, nachala v'yishta v'yishafta ba. When you enter the land that Hashem, your God, is going to give to you as an inheritance, and you're going to drive out the inheritor, the people, and settle it. That's it. That's the only context for the mitzvah of Bikurim. Dwelling, living, conquering, which is the previous part, right before this is the mitzvah of Amalek, of Zechirat Amalek, entering the land. And this is definitely the main part and context of Bikurim that we want to focus on right now. Because when we are analyzing mitzvot in general, and especially when you're analyzing mitzvot in Devarim, when a lot of the mitzvot are given much more context, we don't just want to like learn how to do the mitzvah. We learn why. What is standing in the backdrop of this mitzvah? What are lessons this mitzvah is trying to argue for? And also, one that I want to focus on now is, what kind of things is the mitzvah trying to argue against? Like, what kind of behaviors is in the background of what's happening here that the Torah is trying to avoid? I don't know how much participation we generally have in the beginning of this, but for this thought exercise, so you could try it out for a bit, and if it fizzles out, then I'll lead it. But I want us right now to take off our 21st century hats, put on our hats of our biblical farmers, think in their shoes for a second. You're a biblical farmer. It's going to be hard because we're not like used to living on the land, working from the land. Maybe some of us have experience, but you're a biblical farmer. You put in a ton of work. You plowed the earth. You planted the seeds. You picked it up. You threshed it. You winnowed it. You did everything, and you're getting fruits. What might be some of your reactions for the first time seeing this like bountiful harvest? What might be like your what might you want to do with it? What are some of our options? Anyone? If not, then I'll give like 5 seconds of awkward silence. This is what I do in my classroom.
You want to use it. You're thrilled.
Okay, yeah, you want to use it, and you might want to use it for yourself. Like, it is your hard work that you want. Why would you want to give it away? Right? That is one, like, you don't even need, like, your biblical farmer hat to, like, think this. This is, like, one of the main things when anyone reaches prosperity, which is what, like, the mitzvah Bikurim is slightly about. Like, you just grew the first plants for the first time. Was faced with prosperity, a very normal reaction would be to celebrate yourself. You want to celebrate the hard work you did. This line of reasoning is very, very central to Sefer Devarim. I think in Devarim, more so than almost any book in Tanakh, but definitely more so than any other Sfarim in Chumash, really argue against this idea of prosperity leading to the self-aggrandization of humanity. Not in the context of the mitzvah of Bikurim. Thank you, by the way, whoever answered. I couldn't like see who that was. Not in the context of mitzvah Bikurim, but here's a great, great example. One we'll actually read in English mostly, except for the one pasuk, which everyone should know. Here's another part of Devarim, one we read a couple of parshot ago, where it says Moshe speaking about how when you enter the land, be careful, take care lest you forget the Lord your God and fail to keep his commandments. When you have eaten your fill and have built the fine houses to live in, when your herds and flocks have multiplied and your silver and gold has increased and everything you own prepared, beware. So make your heart doesn't become haughty. And let's skip a little bit just to read this one pasuk, pasuk Yedzayin. It's often quoted pasuk. The amarta b'levecha, you might say in your heart, kochi v'otzem yadi asali et achayel hazeh. You might say in your own heart, my own power and my own hand have won this wealth for me. That idea is antithetical to biblical Judaism, to rabbinic Judaism, to Judaism as a whole, and probably most religions. Like we, when faced with prosperity, right off the bat, one thing that we need to be careful about is letting that prosperity get to your head and self-aggrandizing, almost worshiping yourself. So that is one kind of specter that the mitzvah of Bikurim is going to have to deal with. Now, that part, I think, is very, very easy for us moderns to relate to. But I'm wondering if anyone else can maybe see the other end of the spectrum of what potential problems might exist. I'm going to retell it in a slightly different way, but the scenario I want us to imagine. So you're an Israelite living in, let's say, in all the way northern Israel. That's probably, I never did like Yam Liyam, east to west, which some people hike in Israel, but that's even east to west. Like imagine like walking all the way from northern Israel to Yerushalayim. And like you're far from there. You're far from the Beit HaMikdash. You're far from like the center of Judaism. What might you think or what might you rely on instead? Like, let's say you want to show gratitude. Let's say you want to curry favor in order to have a good harvest the next year. What might a biblical Israelite do? It's not a good thing. We're gonna see.
To thank God locally rather than go schlep to Yerushalayim.
Okay, that is like the really frum thing, which will be great if they did that. But you're thinking, great, like why go far? Might go local, but if you're already going local, and we have to keep in mind, like the Israelites did not live alone. They might not go to their local Kohen or Kohen of Hashem. They might go instead to their local priest of insert Avodah Zara, insert idolatry here. This I did not put in the source sheet yet, maybe in a future version. But if anyone is familiar with the Eliyahu stories, the Eliyahu, the prophet, Elijah, the prophet in Tanakh, he really played up like this fight against Hashem and the major idolatry of that time, of that region, Baal. Baal has a very long history, not just in the area, Mediterranean area of Israel. Like Baal got around. Maybe at the end, if you guys remind me, I have some like fun Baal fun facts that I like talking about. But Baal was the local Canaanite Phoenician god of rain. So Eliyahu, when he is like when people are not worshiping Hashem, he like challenges the priest of Baal to like a sacrifice off. It's a great story. Melachim Aleph around Perek Yudchet. Definitely read it. But we don't even have to read there. I want to read another part of Tanakh with you just to highlight this other tension. This is from Hosea. Hosea is one of the 13 minor prophets. He's very hard to understand in general, so we're not going to focus too much on it. But in this section, he talks about using a metaphor for a unfaithful woman talking about Bnei Yisrael. And she, Bnei Yisrael, did not consider this. It was I, Hashem, who bestowed on her the new grain and wine and oil. It is I who lavished her with silver and with gold, which they used for Baal. Skipping around in this section for a bit, because we're not going to do that much of the textual analysis in this part. And I will end all rejoicing, or festivals, new moons, festive seasons. Why? Because, and thus I will punish her for the days of Baalim, because they offered them offerings. So here, we have, in a way, two different, I would call them specters, like hauntings in the background of what might go wrong when a biblical farmer has their first produce. They might, in the worst case scenario, turn to their local Avodah Zarah, give their grains to Baal, because, you know, their local Plishtim, the local Yevusim, they seem to have good harvest by worshiping Baal. That's one scenario. The other scenario is they might not thank any God. They might just think of themselves. But really, that can't be what is happening here. That can't be the message that Torah wants us to go away with. There's a lot of things to say about the negativity of turning to ourselves and overly focusing on our own achievements without recognizing where they are from. So those are the two specters, the two backgrounds for the mitzvah of Bikurim. Now, when we read the mitzvah of Bikurim together, as we're going to do, we're not going to see any mention of the two things. We're not going to see any mention of Baal. We're not going to be seeing any mention of self-aggrandization. Because there's two different ways to sometimes address negative behavior. There's quoting a pasuk in Tehillim, Sur Meira V'Ase Tov. Sur Meira, turn from bad, V'Ase Tov, do good. Meaning, when you have a behavior you want to fight against, or another behavior you want to strengthen, one way you do it is direct rebuke. I'm a teacher in class. If I want kids to stop talking in middle of class, I could just start following them. Don't talk in class. Trying to say, don't do this negative behavior. But there's a better way, or at least when done conjunctively with the negative, with the sur meirah, the negative repercussions, there's a better way to encourage positive behavior. And that is by channeling it, by driving that behavior to something positive. Instead of saying to my student, don't speak, why don't I teach my student and make my student excited to learn? It's a hard challenge sometimes. But that is another route you can do, and that is the route that Moshe Rabbeinu does when legislating the mitzvah of Bikurim. What we're about to read with the mitzvah of Bikurim, besides the details, is there's not just a mitzvah of Bikurim, of giving the first fruits. There's also a mitzvah called Mikra Bikurim, that there is something that is recited, Mikra means to recite, that is recited by the farmer, a story, a narrative that the farmer is legislated to say, and we're going to analyze that narrative together to see how that narrative helps fight against these two specters and helps channel his energies to a proper worship of Hashem. That is what we're going to focus on. That was a good 15 minutes of introduction. That is like my worst sin always. I love introductions, and I always do maybe go a little too gung-ho on them. But I think now we're fully ready to reread this part of Mikra Bikurim to see how the story that the farmer says, how it shapes his narrative, shapes his understanding, and how it helps fight against both the fulfillment of prosperity getting to his head and also channeling his worship to Hashem. Before we do that, it might actually be worth reading the entire section together. And hopefully a large part of this section should sound very, very, very familiar to all of us. I don't want to spoil it yet in case anyone hasn't read it yet. But once we read it, it's going to be incredibly familiar. So you already read the first pasuk. First pasuk just describes the background, the context. After you inherit the land, conquer the people, start growing stuff, you need to do mikra bikurim and mikra bikurim. So, v'lakachta mireshit kol pri ha'adama asher tavi marzecha asher Hashem elokecha noten lach. So first, you got to bring from the first fruit, reshit, first could mean best, but probably means first here, of all the fruit of the land that Hashem has given to you. Now, there's going to be a very small point, just a small clarification point, one that we can hopefully return to. The actual instructions here is all fruit of the land, but rabbinically, it's actually understood to not refer to all fruit of the land, just the shivat minim, the seven species that are native to, or native may not be the best word, but is exalted in Eretz Yisrael. Let's see if I can remember them all on top of my head. I'm very bad at remembering lists of things. Grapes, oil, olive oils, wheat, figs, dates, pomegranates, and don't remember the seventh. I always forget one. But anyways.
Barley.
Thank you. Whenever there's a list, I always forget one. So those are, it's not all the fruit of the land, just the seven native grains or fruit of Eretz Yisrael. So you, when you grow those seven things, you should take it, the samta, the tena, the halachta el makom asher yivchar Hashem elokecha l'shakin shemosha. You should give it to Hashem. You should place it in a basket. We're going to talk about that word in a bit, tena, and go to the place that Hashem has chosen to dwell his name there, meaning the Beit HaMikdash. V'ata el ha-kolein asher yiyah v'yamim ha-heim. You should go to the priest that exists in that day. V'amarta elav, higadati hayom la'ashem elokecha. And you should say to him, I am about to recite that Hashem, your God, on this day, Hashem, your God, ki va'ati ela aretz asher nishba Hashem la'atenu latet lanim. I'm about to recite something on this day because Hashem, your God, the priest God, has brought him to the land that he, Hashem, has sworn to his forefathers to give to him. That is not the main part of the Mikra Bikurim. This is still all just part of the introduction. The Kohen, the priest, takes the basket from his hand and places it by the altar of Hashem, your God. Okay, so that is the first part. Just a preamble of when you grow the Shevat Minim, you bring it to the Kohen, you say, Hashem, your God has commanded me to bring this to you and to speak something which he's about to speak, place it by the Mizbeah. Okay. There is already, before we get to the main part, but we're going to read the main part first, there's already a lot of questions some of you might have here. We're going to hold on that just for a second, just so we can actually read the part which is going to be familiar to most of you, if not all of you. Va'anita, and then he answers, or rather the farmer recites, Va'marta, and he says, L'fnei Hashem Elokecha, Arami Oved Avi. I don't want to translate that yet, but my forefather was something. We're going to figure that out in a bit. Va'yared Mitzrayma. He went down to Egypt. He went down to Egypt. He dwelt there with little property, but he became a great, powerful nation, a manifold nation. And the Egyptians, they were bad to us. They afflicted us. They gave us hard work. And we cried out to Hashem, our God, V'yishma Hashem et kolenu, v'yiret ednenu, v'et amalenu, v'et lachatzenu. And Hashem heard and saw our pain, our toil, our torment. V'yotzenu Hashem imitzrayim, and Hashem took us out of Egypt. V'yad chazakav zra nituya, with an outstretched arm, with a strong hand, umor gadol v'osam v'fasim. Now, pause there for a second. Does that sound familiar to anybody?
Haggadah Pesach.
Yes, Pesach.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, we say this in the Haggadah of Pesach. We say this, we recite this, just as the biblical farmer did. We recite it during our own retelling of Sipur Mitzrayim. So you already see here that there's some sort of connection, that whatever story we're reading here is almost like the universal Jewish narrative. Like, what is Judaism? what is like the Exodus from Egypt all about is tied to this. We're going to figure that out together. There's one pasuk, though, which I purposely paused there, which we don't read in the Agada, which the farmer does say, and that's an important one. Vayivienu el makum hazeh, and you brought us to this land. Vayitein lanu et haaretz hazot, eretz zavat chalav udvash, and you brought us to this land, the land flowing with milk and honey. It's a bit of an obvious point of why we don't say that during the Haggadah, even though the farmer says it. Because the Haggadah was written in Galut, or at least written in a state of Galut. It wouldn't have been right to say, and you brought us to the land, because we currently, when the authors of the Haggadah, they weren't in the land. So hopefully, like, whenever, and also just in general, this is very off topic, but I'm going to say this anyways. Like, the Haggadah ends with singing L'Shana Haba B'Yerushalayim. I'm assuming because of the lateness of the night, no one's here, like, from Israel. That'd be very impressive. But from the time that I did not get in Israel, we still sing L'Shana Haba B'Yerushalayim. And I sung it while being in Yerushalayim. It was a very weird feeling for myself. But the idea was there that like, we're still, even though we have Eretz Yisrael, we're still in a state of Galut. That being said, like hopefully when the Geula Shleima does happen, we would actually insert this pasuk back into the Haggadah, because that is actually the end of his speech. And you brought us into this land that you promised us of land flowing milk and honey. And va'ata hinei hiveti et reishit pri adama. Now I am bringing the first fruits of the land. Asher natata li Hashem, the land that Hashem gave to me, v'nechtol lefnei Hashem elokecha, v'shtevech lefnei Hashem elokecha. You place the basket in front of Hashem, your God, you bow down. And one final pasuk, a really important one, but it's a little bit separate from the narrative. V'samachta b'chol atov asher natana lecha Hashem elokecha. You should be happy, you should celebrate of all the good that Hashem has given to you, l'veitecha, and with your household, ata, you, halevi, Agar Asher Bersherecha, the Levi and the stranger, the convert, however you want to understand it for now, the lives in your midst. Let's just quickly summarize what we just read together, and then we can fully start our analysis. So, the Mikra Bikurim, the Mitzvah Bikurim is first, obviously, bringing the Bikurim, but he also then recites what scholars, by the way, call an epitome, a fancy word for a narrative. A narrative recitation, a retelling of the Jewish story. He says that, and then he celebrates. So what is happening here, besides just a nice story? We just ended here, are we done? And this is like a big pet peeve of mine when teaching high schoolers, where like, okay, they think they understand something, and they do to a certain degree, and they're ready to move on. But we could do that. We have a nice story. But if we actually reread and try to analyze it more, we could see how there's subtle points here, subtle grammatical points, subtle lexical points, and questions that we could answer that build towards a larger idea to make the Torah more meaningful and more accessible. So we have this all in our head. And let's go back to our original question. How does this mitzvah help strengthen the faith of the farmer, both so that he doesn't worship himself, and two, so he doesn't worship Baal or nature or something along those lines. So with that, we can actually already start doing some light literary analysis. This is going to be done mostly in Hebrew, but I will translate a bunch of it. I hope you guys know this website, because it's a very cool website. What happened here? Zoom got in the way. Okay. Here, I don't know if you guys know this website, Al HaTorah. It has many, many cool things about it. But here's just the section right here, the stuff that we have learned. And they have a cool, like, based off computer programming, they have a feature where you could highlight the most repetitive words in a section. In other words, in Hebrew, we call these milat manchot. in English or in German, I'm quoting Germans because if you like reading biblical scholars, you like quoting the German Leitwort. In English, it's just keywords. A basic understanding of this is if a word is repeated a lot, it's clearly very important to the story. And with that, we can actually just use nice modern programming to help us see the repetitive keywords here. One second. There's this one here, which is just not doing as well. So hopefully, there we go. That's perfect. Let's talk about the one thing that's mentioned quite a lot, over 10 times, is Hashem's name. Hashem's name, particularly the mode of Hashem Elokecha, Hashem, your God, repeats itself, at least Elokecha repeats itself 10 times in these 11 Pesukim. That's two times more common in the section, in the Sefer. I know Hashem's name appears a ton in Tanakh, but it appears more concentrated here. And that's just a very, very simple way of understanding. It's already driving our attention that what is the focus of the Mikra Bikurim? Hashem. Kadosh Baruch Hu. So that's already one part. Another word that's incredibly common, which we're going to talk about for a bit, is the root notain, which means to give. That appears 7 times in this section. Again, driving home the fact, notain means to give, driving home the fact that Hashem, who's repeated a bunch here, he is the driving force of why this farmer has what he has. The farmer might think, Kochi va'otzim yadi. It was my hard work that did this, but Hashem gave him that. Hashem gave him the land to inherit. Hashem gave, and he's now giving the produce. Similarly, the root bo appears 6 times. The root bo is actually cooler here than just natan, because the root bo appears in 2 different forms in this section. Sometimes it means come. That's in the pa'al form, meaning that ki tavo al arts, when you come to the land, or va'at al kohen, you come to the kohen, ki va'iti al arts, when I came to the land. But it also appears in the causative form, hevi, where you bring, Hashem brought you into the land, and you, and therefore are bringing the first fruits. Martin Buber has a whole essay where he makes this point. It's a very cool essay. But just a kind of reciprocity, or not reciprocity, but a continuous moment happening here of Hashem brought you into land, and therefore you have to bring the first fruits. So we see, just focusing on a literary analysis of finding milat manchot, keywords, light words, however you want to call them, it already puts the farmer's minds and us as readers into realizing what is the central themes happening here. Hashem and the relationship of Hashem giving us the land, and therefore us needing to reciprocate in return and give the fruits of the land. So that is already one part of how literary analysis could help our understanding here. Let's now, before we, instead of just focusing on different schools of reading Tanakh, like we could just do more literary skills here, I actually want to go back and forth between more traditional ways of learning Tanakh to back and forth more modern ways. So let's actually now deal with what we call classic Parshanut question here. I'm not sure if anyone thought of this question, but if you carefully read the original speech that the farmer says to the Kohen, one might have 2 questions that Parshanim deal with. Let's read it again. So, Vata al Kohen, you bring to go to the Kohen, Asher Hiya B'yamim Hahen. You should go to the Kohen that exists in your days. Seems a little bit extra. Are you supposed to, am I muted at all? No, I'm good. This seems a little bit extra. What does it mean to go to the Kohen in your days? You're going to go to the dead Kohen? You're going to go to the graveyard and try to go to a Kohen that doesn't exist? Or you're going to go to like a pregnant Eshat Kohen and give it to like the baby Kohen? What does it mean to go to the priest in your days? So Rashi says, yeah, this means priest in your days, similar to go to a judge in your days. Like, don't do wishful thinking, like, I wish I could give it to a priest that was good in back old days, those were the righteous priests. The Ramban gives a different answer, one that we can see easily responds to this kochi v'otzim yadi kind of mentality. The Ramban says, "V'tam ela kohen asher yiyu b'yamim ha'heim, ela kohen asher yiyu sham b'yamim ha'heim." You should go to the priest that is there in those days. Ki heim nutnim la'anshei mishmar tikola karbanot. You should give it to the kohanim that are servicing by the karbanot, by the sacrifices, meaning the kohen in Yerushalayim, as opposed to lo shi'alich imo kohen mi'iro la'akriv bikurav. Don't bring your local kohen with you. Now, why is the Ramban saying this? Besides, like, dealing with this question, what's so bad about bringing your local kohen? Why is it the idea is that you should go to the Kohen of Yerushalayim, the Kohen of the Beit HaMikdash? Because the Kohen is like, doesn't actually matter. We're not actually giving the Bikurim to the priests. As the Pasuk says, you praise it before the Mizbeach. The point is not to like just give your fruits to like somebody like so you could pray to God for you. No, the point of the Bikurim is so that you yourself go to the place of Hashem to encounter Hashem. So we can already see here that like local cults, local avodah, that is not good. You have to recognize the centrality of Hashem in your life. So that's already one question that we would have to deal with. Okay, let's now go back to the pasuk and deal with the second Parshanut question that these sources which relate to our larger question of how does this section help lead us and help build Emunat Hashem. So there's a Vamarta Elav, the farmer says to the Kohen, "Igati hayom, I will now tell you today, La Hashem Elokecha, to Hashem your God." Kiva iti al aret, etc., etc. Let's just focus on the pronoun here. Hashem Elokecha. The farmer is saying to the priest, I'm bringing fruits to your God. Your God? Isn't it the farmer's God too? Isn't the whole point to try to strengthen Emunat Hashem in the farmer and to the average living worker of Eretz Yisrael? Why would he exclude himself? So here we have two really interesting answers. The Sforno, a really interesting Italian medieval interpreter. He kind of gives like a fun, easy answer that it's just to grandize the Kohen. El Kohen Asher Yeh B'Mahem, Af Afi Shel Yeh Gadol B'Chachma, even though he's not maybe so smart or so wise, don't stop to be showing kavod to him. When you were saying Hashem Elokecha. So one way to understand this Sforno is that he's simply just saying, like, you're a god to the priest, to show kavod to the priest, and maybe one could, you know, use their interpreter's hat to talk about how, like, oh, by showing kavod to the priest, he's showing kavod to Hashem. Again, building the narrative of the specialness of this relationship between Hashem as giver and Hashem as, and now the people as giver as well. But the Rabbeinu Bachya gives another more really, really interesting answer to this question. Why does the farmer originally say your God? He says, he really maybe should say Hashem, our God. Because you don't want the farmer to exclude himself from faith in God. However, if he says our God, Lo hayita emunuta mitberet etzlanu. We really won't be so clear about his faith. Why not? Velo yayadim kavanato mihu kore Hashem. We don't really know who he is calling God. This is a really weird thing. What the Benu Bachya is arguing is that he should not say, Hashem, you're our God, because maybe he has a different idea of what our God is. Here's like a really great side thing I could have brought in, but now I'll just tell it to you after, and you could Google it later if you want. This might seem like a strange idea, like, no, there's Yudke Vavke, that's Hashem. Like, why are we confused? Why are we concerned? But what's really cool is, I'm going to get the years wrong because I'm very bad with years. There is an inscription, it's called the Kuntalik Arjud inscription. It's found on a couple of pots. It dates to around 7th century BCE, where it says this jug is donated, but sanctified L'shem Yudke Vavke of the North, and this one is for Yudke Vavke of the South. What these pots show is that in biblical times, there were people in Israel who definitely did not have a view of Hashem Echad U'Shmo Echad. They did not view there was one Yudke Vavke, there was multiple Yudke Vavkes for some of these people. So we clearly see here that Rabbeinu Bachya, not knowing that because it wasn't discovered then, clearly was worried and cared about these issues and thinks, therefore, the reason why the farmer is saying your God as opposed to our God is because when the farmer says to the priest, your God, it's very clear he's now talking about faith in Hashem, Yudke Vavke Echad. Not multiple ones, not different gods, not a Baal with Yudke Vavke, not Yudke Vavke with his Asherah, just Hashem. Okay, so that is the preamble of what we have so far. Now let us actually talk about the main speech that he says, the retelling, the epitome, as scholars call it, of Yitziat Mitzrayim, and we'll try to figure out like why tell these stories in these ways. To best do that, we're going to do some slight literary analysis of this section. As students of Tanakh, I hope that in your other classes, some of you may have already taught the idea of a chiastic structure. Something that's called the et structure. A lot of speeches in Tanakh, a lot of parts of Tanakh, have a very specific structure where it tries to highlight turnabouts or central ideas through a structure of A, B, or sometimes, whatever, we'll just say what's near, A, B, C, B, A. That might sound like nonsense to you, but we're going to show it to you right now. So the speech starts off with, the Anita V'Amarta L'fnei Hashem Elkecha, Ami Ovidav. We're going to call that part A. Then, so first, our forefather was a wandering Aramean, went down to Egypt with little things, came out when then, not came out yet, but became a Goy Atzum Barat. Then, here is part B, which we're going to call it, Vayiru Otanu HaMitzrayim Vayinu V'inu Alinu Vodakasha. And the Egyptians gave us hard labor. And then we cried out to Hashem, our God. That is the central part. And then Chet, the Yatzeni Hashem in Mitzrayim, we're going to call that, that's not B2, B1, that's B2. So Hashem took us out of Mitzrayim, the Yad Chazak of Zeruna to Yom Rogadol V'Otzim V'Asim, with all these great signs, great wonders, and brought us to the land of Israel. I don't know if this is clear for everyone. If it's not clear, then we could do it in the English as well. But the heart of the speech has these five sentences. You have two sentences of the situation that they are in. The pivotal sentence of Hashem hearing them. And then the last two sentences of Hashem saving them. Hashem is not mentioned in these first two parts. The first two parts, A1 and B1, is just told from the human perspective. Our forefather was a wandering Aramean. He came, did not have land. We'll come back to exactly what that means maybe in a second. He had few property and he came a goy rav, and then he went down to Egypt and they were bad to him. And if we stop there, that would be a very bad story. But that's just from the human perspective. The middle pasuk has the middle line of the interaction finally. Hashem is finally reintroduced. Hashem, my God, the God of our forefathers, heard the painful screams of Bnei Israel. And then Hashem did the next two things of taking out of Mitzrayim and bringing us into the land. Just in case the chiasm wasn't fully clear, B1 and B2 are all about Egypt. Egypt being enslaved in Egypt, B2 is being freed from Egypt, and the A1 and A2 is about, A2 is about getting the land, so A1 is probably, and we'll see, is about losing land. So we have here a not just a retelling, but a mini drama that is happening. And it's actually probably worth right now to actually take a step back for a second and just try to like recalibrate exactly what is happening here in the story, in this mitzvah. Like, I'm sure many of us as Jews, we kind of know this, that there's a certain power in stories. There's a certain power in narratives. A good story is not just a riveting tale, a dramatic tale, but it actually is part of self-identity, of trying to figure out who you are, what is your place in the world, in nature, in country, and what is your place with Hashem. And this is a mini narrative that's happening here. A narrative of losing the land, Arami Oved Avi. We're running slightly out of time, so I'm just going to explain the Arami Oved Avi very, very quickly. If you remember from the Haggadah, we translate it as Lavan, who is an Aramean, tried to kill Yaakov, our forefather. Here, though, it seems more like, as Rashbam explains, which I could send out the source sheet later if you would like to read it. It's more about landlessness. Arami Oved Avi, Oved could mean wandering or lost. So our forefather, whether it be Abraham, Avraham, or Yaakov, was a wandering Aramean, did not have a land. Hashem said, Lech lecha ma'artzecha, leave your land. We were landless, and our landlessness led us to a very difficult, troubled place, Egypt. They basically took advantage of our landlessness. But Hashem has saved him, has saved us, has saved the Israelites, and not only took him out of his place of torment, but also gave him a land, also gave him a country, a place, a nation of what to be part of. And that is incredibly what's at heart of the Mikra Bikurim, of realizing your place, the farmer realizing his hard work, but also that his hard work is part of being part of Am Hashem. We not only just see this based off of this chiastic structure. If you read very, very carefully, it's also in the pronouns that is used throughout the story. So we mentioned earlier how he constantly refers to Hashem, your God. Or not constantly, at first he refers to Hashem, your God. But if you read very carefully here, at a certain point, he stops calling Hashem your God, and he stops speaking in the singular, but speaks in the plural. Pasuk Zion, Binitzak El Hashem. And we cried out to Hashem, Elokei Avotenu, the God of our forefathers. And the Yotzi Enu Hashem Mitzrayim, Hashem took us out the farmer is no longer speaking in the singular, because through this narrative recitation of the Yetziat Mitzrayim, he's realizing that he himself is part of a nation. V'yotzi'enu Hashem Mitzrayim. Hashem took us out of Egypt. V'yotzi'enu el makom hazeh. And he brought us new. He brought us to this place. V'yitin lanu et aretz hazot aretz kalat u'dvash. However, it does not end there. And this is probably, I think, the most important part of the Mikra Bikurim, one that deserves a whole shiur in of itself. If you give some references to Rav Kook's thoughts when talking about this, he says, after this whole speech of recognizing how his land, his status of being a landowner is part of the Jewish narrative of not having land, of Hashem giving us land, giving us the land, he recognizes that he's part of the people, but now recognizes his individual responsibility at play here. The ata, now that I've recognized this, hine hiveti et reshit priyadma. I am bringing, no longer we, I am bringing the first fruit of the land, asher natana li Hashem, the land that Hashem gave to me. And I think what's happening here is probably the key to fighting against those two specters that we started off with. So again, just for review and putting the whole shiur in a nutshell, without going through all the maybe smaller parshanut questions. When a farmer is developing his first fruits for the first times, he could attribute everything to himself, or he could attribute everything to a wrong god. And this narrative doesn't argue against that as much as gives him another alternative, which is first saying, which is first recognizing his place in the Jewish narrative. It changes from the you, from the person speaking singular, into the plural, in the first person plural of we. But then finally, after he recognizes his place in the Jewish people, he goes back to recognizing his singular place in it and recognizing his I. And I think that says a lot about the conception of how to live amongst the Jewish people, and also fighting against the potential self-aggrandizement, the kochi, the otzim yadi, which is having, like, if you just focus on the I, on the individual aspects of it, then you're never going to like click with people. They're part of Judaism is living in a community, in the community of people, but also a community of Hashem. So he has to recognize the plural. He has to live a national life. But at the end, he then goes back to talking about the individual, because obviously living a just collective life, you could lose your own self-worth. And you also might not overly devote yourself to something that is wrong. And that's why we always go back to the I. But finally, the last thing which we did want to talk about, and then we'll leave room for some questions, is the last part. And this is probably the most important part of the Jewish narrative, of the telling of the Exodus. It's not just simply recognizing your place with Hashem. It is not just simply recognizing Hashem gave us the land, therefore we need to recognize that fact. But you need to share that good. V'samachta b'chol ha-tov, you should be happy with the tov, but you also should celebrate the tov. Asher nasan lach Hashem elokecha, that the land Hashem gave land to you. Luveitecha, ata ha-levi ager v'sher b'sherecha. You need to celebrate with your household and with the stranger and the levi. The reason why these two classes are singled out is because these are the two landless classes of the biblical Israel. The convert, the land was inherited patrilineally, so the convert does not have land. And the Levi has 42 cities potentially live in, but does not formally have land. So part of the Jewish narrative is not just recognizing Hashem's place in the narrative, but also recognizing the people of need and sharing the good that Hashem has given with you to the people. Jewish people are not just a people of land, but a people of chesed. There's a line from Hannah Arendt that is stuck in my head a little bit right now. I'm going to misquote it so someone could look this up later. But she says that there's a power to narrative. A real power to narrative to help shape what's formed. But there's also a risk of overly defining it. Meaning a narrative works to try to inspire people, not just the Sur Meirav, Asei Tov, to do good because it resonates. But if you overanalyze it and try to nitty gritty, isolate every amount, some of its magic could be lost. And that's kind of what's at risk of retelling these stories too often. But also I think the more you analyze it without maybe going overly defining it, the more you see how the Jewish narrative is built from. Okay. This is just a short telling. We could do a final like wrap up. I think now is probably a good time for questions. There's some chat stuff, which I should have read a little bit earlier. Fulfillment of a contract is a great way of viewing this. Rabbi Kelman?
You can go through the chat box. That's fine.
I'll go through the chat box first. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know who iPad is, but there's a totally different way to read the entire Sefer Devarim, which you're alluding to. That you can read Sefer Devarim as a kind of contract, or in put in more academic terms, as a vassal treaty. Let me explain that very, very quickly because it's very cool, but very off topic. In the ancient Near East, there was a ton of treaties, which we still have, the Isar Hadron Vassal Treaty, the Hittite Vassal Treaty, which is a treaty written by the king to his subjects. And scholars ranging from like a whole range of fields spend a lot of time comparing Deuteronomy, Devarim, to these vassal treaties because Devarim reads like a contract between Hashem, a king, and his subjects, us. So that is definitely one really great way to view it. It's a fulfillment of this contract. I gave you the land, you give of the land. Awesome idea. When one refers to Yudke Vavke in Yerushalayim at the temple, is there any need to add of the south? No. What I was referencing there was definitely in the realm of Avodah Zarah. I was using it as a foil. The Kuntet Arjud inscription is a great example. Here, we say in davening all the time, a pasuk from the Devarim. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hashem is one. That could have very really been arguing against the Kuntel Arjud inscription, which tried to argue there's a north Hashem, there's a south Hashem. So yeah, that's definitely in the temple, in the Beit HaMikdash, there was only Yud Kei Vav Kei, no added descriptions of geography. Any other questions?
Hey, feel free to unmute yourself. My camera's been acting up all week, so I don't know. Something that was not working, but okay. Anyway, yeah, anybody can unmute himself. Next week, next Thursday night, Rabbi Shlomo Gemara. Those in Toronto know him quite well. Rabbi Shlomo Gemara, now the vice principal at CHAT, will be giving the shiur. And tomorrow, of course, my shiur in Pirkei Avot at 9:30 a.m. Sunday, Rabbi Lieptag is at 11, as opposed to 11:15. And Rabbi Helfgott is not going to be teaching this week. He'll be back the following Sunday as the YCT Yom Iyun on Tanakh. And then our full schedule the rest of the week, Monday at 11, Dr. Reinhold finishes his series on the philosophy of tshuva, and Jen Raskis continues her tag team with Rebecca Winter on tshuva in Tanakh. Tuesday, Rabbi, and then it's Monday night, Mark Shapiro and Shol Lieberman, the great rabbinic thinkers, et cetera, et cetera. You got the schedule in the week. You can go on the website. We'll send you emails. But okay, if anybody has anything to add, please do so now. And otherwise, I want to wish everybody Laila Tov. And thank you, Rabbi Berkowitz. Very interesting, presentation, putting in the idol worship aspect of Dvarim that we often don't think about too much. Of course, it's everywhere you look in Dvarim, but sort of using that as the basis for the mitzvah. And I like the Rabbeinu Bachai on the Hashem Elokecha, because he might not be the God of the farm. People had a lot of gods. So they went to the God in Jerusalem. They went to this God, that God. It's sort of very different how we think nowadays, but very interesting. Okay. Thank you very much.
Also, yeah. It's a wonderful lineup. I need to start going to these things.
Yeah, absolutely. please spread the word. I tell people the price of admission is to invite a friend. The problem is I don't collect. I don't tell people they can't come if they're not bringing a friend. I should say, how come you're here? Who's the, you know, everybody should come with a chavrusa and then expand the chavrusa. Baruch Hashem, we have, I think, a wonderful lineup and, okay, we try. And listen, that's been the you grew a beard in Zoom. So we, in the pandemic, we expanded. We moved online from, you know, most of the people here, many people hadn't heard of us before. We were very, very Toronto-centric. I mean, we had people a little bit, but, you know, we used to do all our programs here in Toronto live in person. And that's a different world, especially here. Here, not, you know, here. I mean, shuls are open. Our shul is still outdoors. We're still outdoors, and I'm, you know, that's
my shul is going back outdoors, at least for
right. They went indoors, and unfortunately, back. But listen, we're getting into vaccine mandates here. And chat where I teach just announced today. I mean, it's sort of a nuts, right? They just announced they're going to have a complete vaccine mandate. No vaccine can't come to school. Wow. That's great.
SAR has done that as well.
Yeah, but that's a lot. This is all new the last few weeks. The government of Ontario is not mandating vaccines. They're encouraging very hardly, only in Quebec, not totally, but Quebec, Manitoba, and I think one other province is doing vaccines. And Quebec today released a card that all the security experts are very happy with, like a vaccine, you know, passport. So we don't have that yet in Ontario, but people are pretty good here. I mean, you know, in terms of following guidelines and masking and all that stuff and whatever. So, and vaccines, we're not high enough. We're about 80%, but it's a lot better. It's a lot better than a lot of other places, but not not as high as it needs to be.
Yeah.
And then second vaccines is only about 75%, you know, so.
It's better than, like, I think New York, where, like, the difference between first vaccine and second vaccine is very sad.
Yeah, but listen, our case load is, thank God, listen, much, you know, our fatalities were much less than in the States, much less than in New York, you know. It's whatever, but what can we say? We should have a good year. This, you know, it's about this going on a lot longer than anybody wanted, but I think we got spoiled the last 100 years.
Yeah.
You know, people, we live in such unprecedented times of prosperity and wealth. We sometimes forget. That's what the Torah wants. Kochi votsam yadi, you know, remind that Hashem is running the world. But
yeah.
Anyways.
Good lesson nowadays. Always was a good lesson.
Yeah. But
resonates well.
Yeah.
Resonates well.
Okay. Yeah, anyways, so nice to meet you again, and all the best. Okay. Bye, that's up, everybody. And don't forget, you should bring your friends next week. Okay. And Rabbi, you can spread the word far and wide.
We'll do. Okay. If anyone has any questions, they can feel free, I guess, to ask.
Bye, that's up, everybody. Thank you very much.